food fans. This is Alton Brown, and welcome to the Alton Browncast. Actually, hopefully some of you aren't even, food fans. Hopefully some of you just come and listen because, I don't know, because sometimes you might laugh or learn something on a show like this. I mean, not like, PBS, but, well, actually, that wouldn't be laughing so much, would it? Well, it's kind of like watching the old Saturday Night Live and PBS at the same time. Now, that doesn't make sense either. Anyway, we're going to be taking calls, of course, off of the phones, dealing with some questions that came to us via internet and our email, askalton@altonbrown.com. And hopefully some of those will be food-oriented because that's most of what I know about. But I know a couple of other things too. You can ask me, aviation questions or fashion questions, and I'll embarrass myself on those too. Motorcycles. I love to talk about motorcycles. Or raising kids. I got a teenage daughter. That's a nightmare. So you could, get in touch about that too. And we're also going, of course, to be doing an interview, a fascinating interview. And as you may know, I'm not just into food. I'm also kind of into fashion. I've got a partnership coming up with the guys that are going to be on today. Adam and Corey of the company Hook and Albert, which makes fine ties and other men's accessories. I'm throwing in with them and actually doing a line of bow ties. So we thought we might have them on the show because I think they're pretty cool. They kind of came from out of nowhere a few years ago, making these kind of awesome socks. I'm not a huge sock fan, but I got to tell you, they got my attention. So we're going to have them on the show. So stick around. I think you're going to have a good time. All right, let's see if anybody on the phone's got a question for me. Josh, are you there, Josh?
I am here, sir. How are you?
I'm good, Josh. Where are you?
I am in South Alabama. I know that you really encourage weighing ingredients when baking, and I completely agree with you. I have the digital scale myself and a couple of vintage scales. When measuring flour, what is the typical weight of a cup of flour in metric? I mean, how would you go about that? I mean, so I've seen some of your recipes say that it's about 135 grams or thereabouts. Does it vary, or should it be?
It's not going to vary if once you set, a pound's a pound, and weight doesn't change. So, you're either working in metric or you're working in ounces. But what I do is whenever I have a new scale, I always like to see what it thinks of things. So I'll measure out a pound or, maybe not a pound. I might take a cup. That if I would do a cup of flour, I would shake up the bag a little bit, and then I would do a scoop and sweep. I would scoop in, yeah, and then I would sweep across the top with a knife, and then I weigh it, and I see what the scale thinks of that. And it's usually very close to 4.38 to 4.5, ounces. So that's point. I haven't measured flour by a way other than weight in the last 10 years because, yeah, I just don't see any profit in it.
Very much looking forward to any Good Eats or Good Eats-like type things. I really did love it, and I've got all the books and things like that. So
thank you.
I look forward to the Alton Brown Unleashed YouTube channel.
Actually, I like that name, Unleashed. Maybe we should go with that.
Well, it certainly would apply. Doing whatever you want is always a lot more fun.
Well, thanks a lot, man. Call back again sometime.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye. Hey, Brian, welcome to the Alton Browncast. Are you with me there?
Hi.
Hey, where are you, sir?
I'm in New York, Long Island.
Long Island, beautiful place. What can I do for you?
I was just wondering why a lot of ingredients get not as much recognition as they maybe should. And I think mushrooms and fungus in general are one of them because they're very sustainable and delicious.
Here's the deal. I love mushrooms. Matter of fact, I eat mushrooms in place of meat a lot of times. At any given moment, I've got at least three different kinds of mushrooms in my kitchen. And that doesn't even count dry mushrooms. As far as TV shows go, though, a lot of people just don't like them. And because of that, sometimes networks don't want to feature shows about them because they're not very, quote, sexy, end quote. I'm working up a whole bunch of new mushroom recipes because I like them so much. The one kind of downside is that the regional availabilities are extremely different around the country. So you really have to write recipes just for pretty much white button mushrooms, cumini mushrooms, and portobello mushrooms, which are nothing but overgrown cumini mushrooms, because a lot of people in this country still don't have access to even oyster mushrooms, chanterelles, or morels, much less any of the more esoteric Asian varieties. So a lot of it has to do with, at least with television shows, comes down to availability.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. I like that answer.
All right, well, thanks. I'm glad we could handle that for you. All right, moving on. We've got more callers coming up on the Alton Browncast, and we're going to speak now with Melissa. Where are you, Melissa?
Hi, Alton. I'm in Dunmore, Virginia.
Boy, are you like on a speakerphone on the other side of a very large room?
Can you hear me better now?
Oh, yes. Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, great. I heard that you are going to be doing a tour. Are you going to be making any stops in the D.C. area?
Well, I know that I'm going to be in Maryland. I don't know yet about the D.C. situation.
So what tour, like what would you be discussing on your tour? Is it something like an arena thing? Are you going to be talking to people in universities?
Oh, no, it's mostly like performing arts centers and theaters, okay. You know, 2,500 seat kind of venues. And it's a show that's a mashup of kind of crazy food demos, a little bit of what I'll call stand-up comedy, and believe it or not, live music.
All right. Thank you so much.
You bet, Melissa. Thanks a lot for the call. Take care. All right. It's time to answer some of your questions from AskAlton@AltonBrown.com, Facebook and Twitter and et cetera, et cetera. Here's somebody, I can't even read this name, so I'm not going to try. It says that they've got a bottle of strawberry-infused balsamic vinegar. Other than salad dressing, any suggestions for its use? Yeah, throw it out. There's no reason to buy strawberry-infused balsamic vinegar. It's a unitasker. I mean, get yourself some decent balsamic vinegar, get yourself some strawberries, put them together, put the vinegar on the strawberries, and it's delightful. Why would you buy a product that brings those two things together? You've been had. Take it back. It's useless, because it is. Once you put those things together, I can't imagine. Don't buy that. Take it back. That's all I got myself to say on that. Oh, here's a good one. Jason Connolly wrote in. He wants to know how to grill albacore tuna without drying it out. This is a trick question. In my book, this is a trick question, because albacore tuna, which a lot of American line cod tuna is albacore, is a very dry, flaky fish. And I consider it impossible to grill successfully. And the reason for that is that there's a much better method, which is oil poaching. I put albacore steaks in a pan and cover them with olive oil and slowly poach them, basically making your own kind of oil-cured canned tuna in a way, because albacore is usually canned anyway. And that really does give it the best mouthfeel and best flavor. So consider oil poaching. And you can even put some herbs in there, oil poaching and a little heavy pot instead of grilling that albacore. Thanks one and all for continuing to send in your culinary query and conundrum. So welcome to the Alton Browncast, recording remotely in New York City this week, and I'm meeting with a couple of guys who've kind of changed. I like to think of myself as a relatively fashionable guy, and these fellows have done a lot to kind of make me more fashionable. Adam Schoenberg and Corey Rosenberg of Hook and Albert, and of course Hook and Albert, reference to the watch chain, the Albert in the Hook. So your whole company was kind of based on pulling things together, as it were, and holding things together. And most of you, if you're a fashionable American guy, if you're wearing socks that are in any way interesting whatsoever, you're probably already familiar with these guys. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When you guys first got together, it was at a wedding, right? I mean, is this a real story? Is the PR real? So you guys, you'd never met before.
No, we have.
Oh, you had met before. Yeah, okay, so you had a reason to be there.
Yeah, right? We lost touch for about 10 plus years.
Okay, and you'd gone your separate ways, both into sales management kind
investment
of stuff
banking.
And banking. You were in banking. You were in sales. Adam, you were in sales and in television stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You, so you were not broadcast, but kind of cable oriented stuff. So you come to this wedding, you show up, and for some reason, I don't understand why, you start complaining about socks.
So Corey and I, what we didn't realize, as I said, I was throwing the boutonniere into my flower lapel into my lapel hole, and I was always a sock guy. So even when colorful socks weren't available, I was trying to like buy purple women's hosiery socks and cut them because I knew that it was different and it was fun and I got people's attention.
You were looking for an angle. You were looking for an edge. You were looking to be 100%. Memorable.
Yep, memorable in an authentic way, not in a goofy way. And that I found in socks.
Because some people would say that women's socks, purple socks, are goofy.
Yes.
I'm just throwing that out.
Absolutely. And when I used to wear their pantyhose, that was even worse.
No. Yes. Yes. But memorable.
Yeah, very, very memorable.
Although in New York.
That's true. Very true. So I was always playing with socks. And then when more and more brands out there offered a wider range of unique socks, I just fell into that world.
Corey was in banking, so he couldn't get away with putting a flower, right?
Well, it's,
like, if you put a flower in your lapel, what would have happened?
No, actually, a flower would have worked.
Oh, what have,
a pocket square? Definite no-no.
Are you serious?
Oh, yeah.
A pocket square.
Depending on the level you were in the bank. I was an intern, and this is a true story. I showed up as an intern, great suit, just bought the suit. I found a great pocket square. Showed up with a pocket square. Immediately, someone yanked it out. They're like, what are you doing?
Are you serious?
You can't have this. So,
well, because you weren't high enough up? Was that like big? That was a big dog accoutrement?
It was sort of a status thing, an obnoxious thing is really what the stigma is. And people just didn't let you get away with it. But the flower, I think, it's harmless. You know, it doesn't have any stigma to it, especially in the walls of banking. So I could probably get away with the flower.
But socks, you were able to.
Maybe not the one I'm wearing today, but.
Yeah, the big green. It's large, it's green, and kind of expressive. But socks, colored socks in a banking
socks
environment.
Were able, but right? Socks, I had crazy colored socks. You know, I didn't have to let anybody see them until I sat back, crossed my legs.
Right.
Depending on the meeting, I didn't sit back and cross my legs. But, you know, I had a crazy colored wallet, which I think even Adam gave me some flack over. But
What color was it?
It was
what's a crazy color for a wallet?
It was an old Paul Smith wallet, so it had, you know, crazy stripes, and everything was, you know, stripes on the outside and every color imaginable. So I took this out and put it on the table, and people definitely raised some eyebrows.
Yeah, nobody wants to borrow money from a bank where a guy has stripes on his wallet. Because obviously you're irresponsible with the money. Yeah, okay. Well, that's why. Yeah. You're not going to ever have any money if you do that.
So that's how this whole thing came about, was Corey was able to express himself in a fun, you know, unique, authentic way through socks. I was also. We were both in the wedding party. And I didn't wear normal black socks. So for the black tie event, I had on these crazy purple socks. And Corey had on these, you know, crazy polka dot socks. And during the pictures, it was like one of them were like, oh, cross your legs. And everyone's like, what is with you two? Like, this is a black tie affair. And I kind of look over at Corey and see he's wearing crazy socks and I'm wearing crazy socks. It was like, you know, when one thing's your shtick, you know, and it's like, why are you doing that? That's my thing. No one does that. And that's how the whole conversation about socks started. And then
slow music started to play, our eyes locked.
Yeah.
Got it.
Dreamweaver came on and it was on. Yeah. And then it was just, I think, after probably the fifth, what was it, Fanta and vodka? It was some weird drink that was there.
Fanta grape or Fanta orange?
It was orange.
It was orange.
Fanta orange and vodka.
That was like the drink in Sweden. After like the fifth one, you know, I think it was one thing led to another. And we're like, you know, Corey wanted to kind of pivot out of banking. I was looking for that.
Clearly tired of the abuse.
Yeah, tired of the abuse of getting his pocket squares yanked out. I wanted to leave, you know, my world of you know, advertising sales for a while. And we're like, yeah, let's start a sock company. We both like socks. And never thinking this whole thing would actually, you know, we'd follow up. We'd figure out if there was a void in the market, which we saw that there was. And that's kind of how the sock conversation started in this
world. Did either of you know anything whatsoever about textiles, about manufacturing of this kind of product?
The only thing we knew what we liked and we knew what we didn't like.
That's it. So what's the first step when you say, okay, we're going to make socks? Great, we're going to make socks. Great. How do we make socks? I mean, what do you do? Well, I mean, who's the first call?
We sort of lucked out in that department. I went to business school at Virginia, mm-hmm. and I knew a lot of Peruvian friends. So it was one of those really stupid questions that turned out to be a really smart question. I reached out to one of my Peruvian friends and said, you know, Adam and I discussed it. We want to make socks where the cotton is best. Peru, Peruvian Pima cotton. Do we know anybody there with connections? Find a factory. So I reached out to one of my friends, said, I've got a very stupid question. I know you're Peruvian. Do you know anybody who makes socks in Peru? I mean, think about that question. It's
because that's kind of like saying, if I tell a friend I'm going to New York, and they say, oh, do you know such and such?
Exactly.
Yeah, we meet all the time.
It's the dumbest question in the world, and she said, absolutely. She's like, this is great. I can connect you to the best sock manufacturer. So through that connection,
that's not possible.
I know.
It's impossible.
And that's what we knew. It's, you know, this is a lot easier than we thought it'd be.
Well, sure. It took you one call.
That's it.
Exactly right.
But there was, I mean, it was, that's the first part. So you can have someone who make the sock for you.
Right.
Going back to what Corey says, we knew what we liked and what we didn't like. Mm-hmm. And we did spend about a year prior to ever making the first sock thinking, is there even a market for this? And this is, you know, right now the sock craze is everywhere, right? There's, you know, you have celebrities that are out there making socks. You have athletes making socks. If we rewind now at this point, almost 3.5 years ago, probably when this first came about, it was Paul Smith doing crazy socks or colorful socks, per se, and that was it. So we looked at the market, the higher-end market, said you have five players in the space. You have brands like Corgi, Pantherella, Falk, Paul Smith. No one has done anything radically different. So how can we tinker with that sector? How can we really, you know, reinvent something that's never been reinvented? Now, these are phenomenal heritage brands. We're not going to take anything away from that. But we were tired of buying $30, $40 socks and weren't fitting us properly. So we knew we wanted to do something, and that what it was specifically took us a very long time until I was training for a triathlon. And I bought a pair of high-end athletic socks. And they had arch support and padding and specialized stitching. And I went, this makes no sense. My feet feel great. I spent $40 on a sock that I wear for 40 minutes at most training. But I spend $40 on, you know, dress socks that I'm on my feet for 13 hours a day. That's when kind of the aha moment, you know, Canvas had called up Corey. I said, here's our angle. We need to rip this sock apart and rebuild it and actually do things that work for the foot, not just the shelf. And that's when the whole entire, well, what do we do? And then we talk with our manufacturers, and we want to put in arch support. And we know that arch support increases blood flow and helps foot fatigue and all this stuff.
Right.
So that's how the whole thing kind of
started. And our manufacturer, I mean, he is now a close friend. Then he was taking a chance on two guys who didn't know the industry, didn't know socks. We knew patterns we liked, but we knew sort of where we wanted to get to.
Mm-hmm.
But he really was instrumental in teaching us.
Why do you think he took the gamble to even mess with you?
You know, that's a good question. That's a good question.
I think it's probably fun for him. You know, like he works with so many established brands.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's like the same thing, right? You get an order, you fulfill it, you have your people make it. But I think to watch, you know, would I still consider us knuckleheads, you know, had an idea, and to watch us blossom. And he talks about it all the time when we're in the factory in Peru. He's like, you guys, you know, started with nothing, and now we're, you know, pretty big size brand within those walls. Mm-hmm. So I think it's probably he enjoys it a lot to watch us start and grow.
Yeah.
So
how often do you go down there?
Probably about 2 to 3 times a year right now. And sometimes we'll probably change it to about 5 times a year. And the reason is every time we go, we learn something. So that's the beauty of what we do, is every single day, whether it's on the business front or the manufacturing front, we learn something. And when we go there, it's understanding new machines, it's understanding new patterns, it's understanding new yarns that come out. And from season to season, we wear these socks and go, you know what, we want to make the calf band a little bit tighter. How do we do that? You know what, it's a mid-calf sock. How do we make it a little more sturdy? And it's just having those conversations in person is a lot more productive than just, you know, a phone call or a Skype, which is what we did when we launched the company.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to.
Yeah. Or, I don't think we could afford to hop on the flight.
Yeah. We're not going to run down to Peru and work that. Is that still what makes their cotton so great, by the way?
I think it's just the way that it's the way that they actually are combing the cotton, the silkiness of it. I think there's a weather component to it. There's some great cottons that are around. I just think for whatever reason, the Peruvian Pima with the silkiness and the fluff to it and the purity is just so much different from what else you find in a regular Supima or an Egyptian cotton. Yeah.
Better for socks.
Yeah, absolutely. Better breathability for socks, too. I mean, what's shocking is the foot has 250,000 sweat glands, right? So when you think about that, you're like, oh, my God. So you really need something that not just looks good, but, you know, absorbs the feet, keeps your feet staying dry, you know, cool. And the Peruvian Pima cotton gives you that hybrid approach between a casual sock that you can wear, you know, with a pair of jeans on a weekend or, you know, with your suit. And it's not your typical washed merino, which also is a great, you know, wicking component.
Right.
But wicking. It just feels really good all year round. About 2 weeks ago, we were talking in front of one of our retail partners. They had all their managers in. And someone asked a question of, you know, what's your philosophy behind all this? And Corey and I say this all the time, where today's world, right, the past decade, there's been this crazy shift. Everyone tries to be a little bit different. And we always joke because when everyone's trying to be different, right, and trying to pivot to the right, well, everyone's kind of the same. In menswear, if everyone's doing a fitted suit, sure, you have different brands, but a fitted suit's a fitted suit. So how can you be different in a really authentic way? You know, guys like you and your style is exactly what we built this company on. It's you're not doing it intentionally. It's just because you like it, and screw it. If someone likes it or doesn't like it, it's your unique style and your unique brand. And at Day's End, I think that's what everyone wants, right? You want that own personal style. You want your own personal brand. For me, it was a real flower for years. For mm-hmm. Corey, it was a pair of socks and, you know, in his world. And I think that that's what we offer. It matches, it matches. If it doesn't, it doesn't. And we want to be the guys that say, it's okay.
It's okay.
You know, it's okay to do it.
Which one of you came up with the idea of these flowers? These lapel flowers.
Yeah, I mean, it was really both of us. Everything we've done is kind of a collaborative effort. I was always wearing a real flower in my lapel for the longest time. So prior to getting involved in this venture, I was a salesman in advertising world.
Right.
So I saw the power of throwing a real flower.
An actual boutonniere.
Into my lapel. And when I'd sit with like the CMO of a company and try to pitch why my network was great, I knew I had his attention because he was always looking at my lapel.
Right.
So I knew the power of the lapel, but no one was doing anything with it. So Corey and I was just saying, hey, I do this. What could we, you know, do if this thing's so powerful? What could we make and create? And we found, I think, on a blog, some guy in Europe that was doing some really cool stuff with his lapel. And Corey's like, how about we do a throwback to the boutonniere? We don't have to do something real and live. And that led into the original lapel flower, which was a crochet. And that's how this whole thing blossomed.
I've seen a picture of some of the original.
The original, yeah.
Yeah, it was really a great texture play.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that nice handmade crochet that, you know, traditionally you think of that old woman sitting on a train knitting something crochet and put it on.
So where'd you find her? Did you have like a whole subway full of women kind of sitting and crocheting these flowers?
We almost had to.
Our grandmother worked really hard.
Yeah. Our first, I mean, that was one of the first products we launched with. Mm-hmm. And we had the only factory that was making them in the quantities we needed was overseas. So it was one of the biggest lessons we learned because half of these things came into the country and the buttons were falling off like 50%. Mm. Our first account was Bloomingdale's and we had to deliver this Bloomingdale's order with like half the buttons were off. And it was just a nightmare. And we're like, do we have like, you know, my old Jewish grandmother, can we send her like 5,000 of them to start her like, you know, sewing them on? So it was interesting, interesting venture, the first version, the vintage flower.
The vintage flower. Yeah. And then how long until you started making them here?
It was actually pretty immediate.
Yeah. It was within, I'd say, 3 months.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
And thank God we did. We knew that we loved the idea from a macro standpoint. There were limitations. You only have certain colors of yarn. You can't really get very, very big, and you can't do these 3D textures. And we ended up connecting with a wonderful, you know, partner here in New York who was able to make just a wide, you know, range of these flowers. And then we were able to play with actual textures and actual fabrics, and it was just endless. So thank God we met those guys. And yeah, after 3 months, we were like, all right, old is gone into the new, and we've never looked back since.
The first time I wore one of your lapel flowers, I wore the biggest, most obnoxious one that you guys had sent me. And someone that I work with said, literally, why are you wearing that? And my answer, which completely stopped the conversation, was, I like it. Done. We're done here. I'm wearing it because I like it. But I don't think that men in this country are used to that answer. Mm-hmm. Are used to saying, number one, I have an opinion. I'm willing to make a statement, or I'm willing to do something just because I like to do it.
Yeah.
You know, in menswear, I don't think guys are used to that. Mm-hmm. It's used to, you know, I'm going to wear this because it makes, you know, I'm supposed to because I'm this guy and, you know, I work here. Mm-hmm. And so they become defined by, you know, either what their wife picks out for them, which is probably the worst thing ever, have your wife pick out your clothes, or, you know, because I'm a member of this club and I'm a member of this, you know, association or this job, which I think has probably been detrimental. You know, that works in England where you've got, you know, that's your club tie you know, there's your rep stripe, you know, okay, mm-hmm. those are cool. That's okay. Yep. But over here, we don't have that.
Yep.
You know, what we've got is, you know, pants with 16 pleats and an ugly polo shirt with a badly embroidered logo from a golf club. Which is, I wear that if you like that kind of thing. So you make this the socks, mm-hmm. and then you look at each other and say, wow, we did that. And look, everybody sells them. And I mean, how many places sell your socks now? They're everywhere.
We sell to a lot of places, you know, major big box retailers like Saks and Nordstrom, and probably at this point about 450 specialty stores all across the country.
The first socks I had of yours, I bought it at Nordstrom.
Oh, very cool. Great. Yeah. Very cool.
Thank you for
the support.
Certainly. Thank you for the support. that, you know, more foot support. Yeah. So you do the socks and you look at each other and say, so, guess we should probably do something else.
Yeah. That was him, actually. That was all Corey.
The conversation, you know, again, as Adam and I reconnected and had this conversation about socks, we noticed more and more people joining in the conversation. And it became sort of this, I hate my socks. I can't stand, you know, these socks I bought yesterday. And everybody's having the same complaints. Well, you transition that to a much larger conversation. Well, what else is going on in menswear? And the answer is, I don't know where to get any accessories. The small things. I have no go-to brand. I don't like what I'm getting. Bracelets are mundane, or wallets, although mine was striped, I had some issues with it. Guys were complaining that there was just nothing out there for them and nothing that really fit everything that they wanted. So
now, who are you talking to? You keep saying guys. Who are these guys?
General guys. Guys who, like you, like us.
Just guys you're meeting.
Yep.
Just,
yeah.
It was bar conversations. It was our network of friends, his business school guys. It was anyone
we were not
we talking
shy
about.
Sparking up conversation with random people on the street.
With flowers on our lapel. It was a very
and
unique experience.
And this was,
experience.
You know, we tried to, you know, spark it with not just close friends, but complete strangers. Because complete strangers, more times than not, they are very vocal in giving you their opinion. And, you know, when we started up the business, they were very vocal. They had very, very strong opinions about what we were doing. And we transitioned it to say, look, a sock brand, it's not just about socks for guys. Guys are missing the small things that actually make that huge difference in their wardrobe, that actually make you walk down the street, you know, feeling more confident, feeling more comfortable. And a lot of these brands are making a lot of accessories as just a tertiary, you know, small component to their larger business.
SKUs. Just need
exactly,
some SKUs.
That's exactly right. And they stamp their name on it, and they commoditize the entire accessories business. And they're not sacrificing anything. It's the customer. It's us who's going to end up sacrificing. So Adam and I, you know, again, at that moment, we're like, look, we've got to make this even bigger. We are a brand that's focused on accessories, and that's it. And it's bringing to market accessories that guys really, really enjoy and don't sacrifice anything, fit, function, and fashion. It's fusing all those together.
You know, it's interesting. I know a lot of guys that and actually started going back and going rummaging through their dad's stuff and their grandfather's stuff, looking for a word that you've now used four times, authenticity, mm-hmm. Looking for something that's not normal, not everyday, not out there by the zillions. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know about you guys, but I hate running into somebody wearing my suit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I mean, I really hate that. Or somebody that you could mistake for me. I don't want that. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to be distinct. And so I see guys now wearing a lapel pin or a tie bar, something that they got from that's vintage, mm-hmm. you know, because they're looking back because authenticity is such a difficult thing to find now.
True.
In this world. How much is that overall search for authenticity that guys have now in general kind of affect what you do? Or are you still just making what you want to make?
Well, we draw our inspiration from exactly what you said. I mean, it's finding those vintage pieces, finding those items that really made up a guy's wardrobe eons ago. And, mm-hmm. you know, this will bring it full circle. That's where the name came from, Hook right. and Albert. It's, you know, drawing
the Albert being the watch chain and yep. then the exactly. held together. So there's kind of a symbol of holding things
exactly.
together and presenting things.
Exactly right. And if that small piece, which, you know, the watch could be $1 million, but it's tucked away in a pocket.
Yeah.
But that small piece, that chain, if you didn't pay attention to the detail of that chain, the Albert, and that hook that attached the button, your entire look is ruined. And it's, you know, it's drawing inspiration from those steady pieces mm-hmm. that guys have had throughout the years who have, you know, lost. And guys, again, you see these waves of attire for guys. You know, it used to be, you know, everybody was dressing dapper. Then it was everybody was casual. Now it's finally starting to come back around and people are dressing and looking, you know, for that dapper way again.
Well, you know, vintage is huge these days. I mean, are we overfixated on old and we should just start creating new stuff?
Well, I you know, I think at Day's End, it goes back to offering guys a way to promote their personal brand. It's offering guys the opportunity to maybe receive a compliment they probably weren't going to get. It's offering guys a way to engage in a story they may not know they were going to, you know, have. I mean, or tell, excuse me. So I think all that comes to what we offer. Like you said it best, you don't want to walk across the street and see a guy in the same suit you're wearing. And I think if we can help you put a purple lapel flower on that suit and it makes it a little bit different.
Right.
You know, that's what we're all about. You know, I always love the analogy of parents. I'm a fairly new parent, right? And parents trying to redshirt their kids, right? I'm going to hold my kid back so he's smarter. But if that's the trend, and if all parents hold their kid back and they all get released at the same time,
then guess
on
what?
The same playing field.
It doesn't
work.
Matter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing with like our philosophy with everything going on where, you know, if everyone's trying to push the same button with fashion, and that's fashion has always been that. There really isn't that, you know, radically different brand. We just want to be the guys that give you that little sprinkle of something that's different. And I think that's our philosophy with everything that we produce. And plus, we look at everyday things and go, how can we make it better? I mean, we're getting right now into launching cufflinks mm-hmm. this coming season that, you know, for years we loved the casual look and the texture of your traditional silk knotlink.
Right.
But, you know, it's two balls that you're trying to shove through a tiny slit on a shirt, and from a functional standpoint, that takes forever.
It can be pretty frustrating because you're working with one hand.
One hand, exactly. So. Or some guys will take their shirt off, do it out, you know, outside of the arm. Right. Then they shove their, you know, fist through it, stretches the elastic. It's a mess. And we looked at this and we go, well, why? Why is this the only thing that's there? So we go to the drawing table and we're like, how do we make this thing better? How do we make it more functional? How do we make it so that you can do it with one hand? You're not going to miss your train, you know, trying to put this thing through, but you still get the look of this piece.
And you've actually done it.
And we've done it.
You've done it.
And that was one of those, you know, prime examples of a commoditized accessory for men.
Sure.
You know, there are...
There's one factory in the world making all of them. Yeah. And then
all these great packaging factories putting different names on it.
Right.
And no one took a step back and said, all right, this thing is a great seller. People love it, but people also hate it. And while it's easy, people are very frustrated. But again, because no one focuses on it,
right.
Why change it?
So, of course, this is a podcast, so you can't actually see them. You could go to Hook and Albert's website and see them. But basically, you've got the ball is still on one side, yep. and then the elastic is there, and then there's an appropriate metal bar on the other side, which makes complete sense. And it's one of those things that you look at and you say, yeah, why didn't we do this before? Because this is pretty obvious, mm-hmm. and now I feel stupid because this is easy, so to speak.
Sure.
But I don't see anybody else doing it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that... No one else is doing it yet. I'm sure it'll be, you know, we've had the fortune of launching very unique things into the marketplace, and it's a huge compliment to see the market then gravitate, you know, towards it. So I think at some point, because a lot of the stuff we do, you can't patent a lot of the stuff we do.
You can't patent a lapel flower.
Exactly.
They're just not going to patent office. Ain't going to do it. Although it'd be great to see the paperwork. Yeah, you guys could file for that. I would pay to just see the paperwork. Dimensions.
Exactly. And we've tried with a couple things, and we've learned our lesson on it. But you know, I think that when someone sees that, you're going to start seeing more and more brands. You know, probably say, "Oh, that's interesting," because now, whether you're Charvet, whether you're Brooks Brothers, whether you're Isaiah, whether you're Macy's. There's no branding on it except for the packaging, as Corey said, from the physical product. We were able to say, wait a minute, if we take this barbell you know, component, we're able to actually brand the sides.
You
and we want
sides.
Someone to know that it was Hook and Albert who, you know, kind of created this unique little thing. So,
have you seen your stuff ripped off yet?
Yeah,
who's ripping you off?
Yeah.
Oh, come on, man. Who's doing it?
We can't mention anything.
Well, I mean, I don't – is somebody else making lapel flowers or is somebody else just making crazy socks?
From
a
macro standpoint, we'll say this. The lapel flowers, we were very excited to see that guys are using the lapel in general in different, more functional ways. The beauty, I think, about our business and our standpoint on it is we have really created the marketplace for it. I mean, we're national with Saks, with Bloomingdale's, with Nordstrom. So – when these other guys come into the space, people are going up to them and say, oh, is that a Hook and Albert flower? And that's a huge compliment.
It's like Kleenex. You've got the flower, the lapel thing. You're there.
I think with the colored shoelaces, you know, people laughed at us and said, I'm never, yeah, sorry, you're wearing
that. You know, it's funny. Here I am. they're a little long for these desert boots, so I just kind of double knot them. But
they look good.
It's funny. I now travel with like five different pairs of colored shoelaces.
Great.
One day I'll throw in orange, and I'll throw in kind of these burgundy ones you guys gave me. And always, I will always, every day, get a comment about them.
That's the beauty of it. And to look around to fantastic brands doing it now. I mean, the colored shoelace and the colored sole thing is in.
Yeah.
So you have a lot of bigger brands doing that.
But the shoelaces are just not as expected.
They're not.
You know, they're not. I'm already kind of over the colored sole thing.
Yeah.
Because most of the materials that go into those shoes can't. It's like... A brand I won't name. I bought my first pair of like fabulously colored sole shoes, and was here in New York working for a July, and 1 month of walking in hot New York streets July, and the shoes were done. They wore off. The heels wore off. It's not tough enough material.
Exactly.
But I can take the colored laces and I can put in you know, a pair of 15-year-old Italian shoes, and it's like it's a new shoe.
Yep.
Oh, my suggestion though, you really had to think about packaging some laces with flowers.
Yeah.
So it's like this part of these flowers match these.
Yep.
It's just because guys like your animals.
They do.
You know,
they do. Yeah, you're, and you know what? We've been trying to get better with that. And that's that's one of our biggest, you know, every single day is how do we help the consumer in a more authentic and better way on our website.
Mm-hmm.
I threw in the word authentic again.
Cause you did. That's number five, by the way, for authentic. That's clearly where you're going on this.
I woke up today. I think that was the word of the day on Sesame Street this morning.
Authentic.
Authentic. So no, I think that the laces are exactly what you said. We're getting guys now who it's like interchangeable cufflinks. You know, just I'm gonna bring a bunch of these old silk knotlings. I'm gonna throw them in if I want purple today, if I want pink, and the laces are just an extraordinary component. And then the loafer liners, which I'm wearing today, and Corey's wearing.
Yeah, I don't have loafer liners. I admit, I do not have any loafer liners.
So you know, for those that don't know, the loafer liners is no show sock. It's we call it a male ped. But you know, again, going back, your feet sweat. You should never probably not wear socks. It's not good for your feet. It's not good for your shoes. It's not good for the people around you. No one was doing them in crazy colors. And we were the guys that said, you know what? It's for you to know, right? No one's going to see them, but maybe if you're in the airport security line, you take off your shoes, it's a good conversation starter. And today you look on, you know, the racks and everyone's doing them. So I think you can't get frustrated. I think that's fashion. And you know, for us, we continue to try to be the trend leaders, first in market with really unique things. And if there are guys and or brands that come about and try to, you know, replicate it, that's awesome. I mean, that's I think the best, you know, great job to us.
But then at some point you decided to move into other people's territory. Mm-hmm. I mean, because then, you know, you decided to make ties.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the mission statement with ties? Let's face it, there's some good ties. Mm-hmm. There's some extraordinarily good ties out there. What was the philosophy that allowed you to say, okay, now we can take this into a different area with ties?
Well, ties was it was something that we thought of, and another one of those pieces that was hard to find was a simple, solid, multifunctional tie. And multifunctional meaning you can leave in the top drawer of your desk. I was in banking. Again, he was in ad sales. You never knew when you had a meeting to run out to. Maybe you wanted to wear a tie, maybe you didn't. But on the day that you didn't, inevitably there'd be a meeting. Who knows what you're going to be wearing? So our philosophy with that is to take these really solid core colors, make an amazing tie and a great width. You know, not the drastic, really wide tie and not the too skinny. So we did a 2 5/8 width tie. Which we consider to be a really elegant length and works with a suit, works with casual, works with everything. And we did it in these five basic colors.
Mm-hmm.
And our philosophy there was you can keep any one in your top drawer. And it will most likely, I'd say 90% of the time, go with anything that you had. So it's that staple tie that you can get.
How did you decide on those five colors? And tell us what the colors were, by the way. I know what they are, but I want you to
say. We had light gray, mm-hmm. navy, brown, green.
Mm-hmm.
And I think
khaki.
When did the burgundy one hit? Because that's the one
I travel with that burgundy tie
because it goes
burgundy and the navy is
all over.
Yeah,
yeah.
Those two are great. Those two and the light gray were really our staples. I mean, we had those and it was not a question. We needed a light gray, a burgundy, and a navy.
Right.
And those just go with everything. And
I've got a peach one.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We do.
Yeah, the peach
we
one.
We ended up rolling it out to a total of 10 ties. So 10 ties. Spring, summer, and then a fall, winter collection. But yeah, I mean, it was the seersucker suit. It was a navy suit. They went with everything, and the details. You know, you're talking self tipping on the tie.
Mm-hmm.
A grosgrain.
What does that mean? What is self tipping?
So self tipping is a way of if you turn the tie inside out, and you actually know if you look at the tip of the tie, it's the same fabric that's used to actually close it up. Versus sometimes you see a silk liner in it or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Hand tacking is the actual tacking that closes the ties together.
Done by hand, as opposed to dumped on a machine somewhere.
And we did it in a color that then paired back to the grosgrain ribbon,
mm-hmm.
which the grosgrain ribbon you traditionally find on a knit tie like what you're wearing today.
I have one on.
And it allows for better wear and also on the neck more durability throughout
well,
the day.
Well, it slides.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Grosgrain, slides
slippery,
easier.
Kind
exactly.
of satiny kind of thing.
And no one was doing that on a traditional tie. So it's all about the details that you throw in. So on the navy tie, for example, we had red grosgrain strap matched with the red hand tacking.
Got it.
So it's those little things.
That red tacking, by the way, is distinctive and it's just a little.
It's just enough.
That's it. And I'll tell you candidly, ties were a tough seller for us because when we launched our ties, you had a lot of brands that were doing big, bold plaids and using these seersucker materials. And for us, we were actually going back to just the classic, you know, look. I mean, I could wear a navy tie every day. And that was our philosophy with ties. When the marketplace, their philosophy was very different.
Right.
So it was a good learning experience for us. And I think we weren't upset because we firmly believe in it. And anyone who purchased our tie goes, it's a great, great tie. We really, really like it. So I think, you know, that was one thing that we went, you know what? It wasn't a huge success. Like, it wasn't the trend starter, but we knew that we made something that was phenomenal. It was well-crafted, and there was thought behind it. And for us, it's all, you know, it's all we care about.
See, I would have thought that the whole Mad Men thing would have played very well into your solid ties,
yeah.
You know, and because I think guys are getting back into solid ties. Yeah. I love solid ties because it's a little less decision I have to make. I want to ask you guys about making stuff in America. Most of your stuff is. I mean, a lot of it. You got your Peruvian socks, but you seem to be pretty dedicated to American craftsmanship and having things made here. Is that difficult considering what you do?
Yeah. Well, I mean, before we say, you know, we're completely dedicated to making things in the U.S., what we are dedicated to doing is making things where they make sense.
Ah.
So it's, you know, there are a lot of companies that are dedicated to making things in the U.S.
That make absolutely no sense.
Don't make any sense. And the U.S., they may not have certain machinery that makes sense for that item. But they're so dedicated to making it in the U.S., they make an overpriced item that isn't made well. And I think at that point, everybody suffers. Yes, you're, you know, creating these jobs, or you think you're creating these jobs, but it's not really in the right area.
Right.
You know, and again, it's back to where does it make sense? For us, a lot of these items happen to make sense in the U.S., which is great. And it aligns with us. But again, like the socks, Peruvian Pima cotton, we're going to go to the source. We're going to go to where they know best. And they make one hell of a sock.
I would expect, though, that making things here allows you for a certain reaction time. I mean, you're there at it more.
There's nothing that's better than that. I mean, our lapel flower business is, you know, we're the largest lapel flower manufacturer in the country. When you have someone like Saks on a weekly basis calls you and says, hey, I have an idea. Can we do this by next week? The answer is yes, because I can go right down to our factory. We can go source the fabrics we need to do, play with designs, and get it done. When you're dealing with Peru or, you know, you're dealing overseas with a certain product, there is that time, right? There's Peru's not that way, but, you know, Asia, you have the time difference. You have a holiday every other week. It's there's different things that, you know,
and language problems and all kinds of things.
Exactly, all of it. So, yes, it makes things a lot easier for sure to do it here, for sure.
To do it here.
Yeah.
And you make most of your ties here as well.
All ties, all lapel flowers are done here. Yeah.
And the cufflinks, where are you guys doing the cufflinks?
Cufflinks are done overseas.
Of course, I should mention, we're going to make some bow ties together.
Yes,
we should mention that.
Yeah.
Pretty excited about that.
Very cool.
So we've got like five that are going to be coming out. Absolutely. I did. I was on Good Morning America, and they had this. Somebody had sponsored this kind of like bad tie thing, and all the guys were wearing this hideous ties, and it was a joke.
Sure.
And they took me and said, "You want to wear a tie?" I'm wearing a polo shirt, Sunspell polo shirt. So I was like, "Well, I'm not really outfitted for that, but okay." And they brought me into this pile of ties and all these bow ties. I'm like, "Why aren't you guys any of you guys wearing bow ties?" And not one of them knew how to tie a bow tie.
Yeah.
I'm like, "Okay, we're going to school, fellas. Yeah. Watch this." and they're all kind of like, "Wow, that's not hard."
Yeah.
I might wear one of those. I'm like, yeah, it's no fuss at all. And it's, you know, funny. Bow ties are, you know, I used to get really weird looks. You know, I started wearing them because in the cockpit of a plane, I would get tangled up. My tie would get tangled up in harnesses and cables. And I found when I started wearing bow ties.
It's always a great thing to get tangled up.
Well, you know what? You just don't want to.
If you're
you're shooting an ILS in bad conditions down to freaking Teterboro, and you're tangled up in your tie. It just doesn't make any sense. So I started wearing bow ties. Like, wow, I'm free now. But it came out of functionality, you know, for me, the bow tie thing.
Sure.
But the line that we're doing is really great. They're mostly reversible.
Yeah.
I'm in love with the camo. South, I've been wearing, I know it's more
and you
of
and I fought for that one, I think, right?
Loved the camo. Every guy there says, like, that's camo on the back. I'm like, yeah, it is.
Yep.
Yeah, you want one of those? You want that? Yeah.
I'm excited, you know, to bring these to the guys that, again, like you said, haven't tied a bow tie ever.
Yeah.
You know, because
the bow curious. They're bow curious.
I love that.
Yeah. I think everybody's a little bow curious.
Yeah.
I think,
you know,
so. The South, though, we're actually behind the curve down there.
Really?
It's bow ties are on fire in the South. Everybody's got a bow tie. You know, some
that's
of the
great
old kind of bespoke shops in Charleston and places like that have always had them.
Yeah.
You know, you go into a menswear store off the square in Oxford, Mississippi, bow ties.
Yeah.
They're all over the place. The bow tie thing, we got to get on that.
You know, it's the production of it, right, is the easy part. It's we're dealing with, on our ties, so many different fabrics. So you have fabric content, labels, and, you know, things people don't know.
Because most of our ties, by the way, are two-sided.
Yeah,
they're reversible.
Two-sided, so you have. And not one two-sided is the same. So I don't know how many.
We must have about
at least 10 different fabrics.
Yeah, 10 different fabrics.
And they don't always get along with each other. Exactly. I mean, they're not naturally together.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of what we're doing. I'm really excited about it.
I think
that, you know, bow ties, for us, it's all about when does it make sense to get into that vertical. Mm-hmm. And bow ties were, you know, a lot of brands have been doing it, but to have it done with someone like yourself who gets them. I mean, for those that don't know, our first meeting, I mean, you probably knew more about the bow tie than any one of us, you know, maybe next to Donna, but even Donna, she had to be schooled on bows. I mean, so what we look for is when you do a collaboration and when you work with somebody, you want to make sure that it's authentic. And we get calls all the time from, hey, can you do a sock line for this celebrity or for this athlete? And we're like, whatever, like, what does he know about it? You know, and for those that don't know, I mean, Alan came in and you knew more about fabric content and construction and
heritage. I was studying.
I was studying.
I don't know a lot,
awesome.
But I'm studying.
You know, yeah,
because it's interesting.
So awesome.
It's interesting.
It is.
And your collection is so impressive.
Yeah, it's.
I got a lot. Yeah. I got. Yeah. Well, I inherited a fan who sent me 145 bow ties, so I really have been kind of trying to study those, and guys have been asking, well, how many ways are there to tie a bow tie?
Yeah.
I'm like, well, you'd be surprised. A lot of ways to tie a tie in general, much less a bow tie.
Exactly.
So,
and that's, I think, also what I'm excited about, you know, through our partnership to help guys is to know, you know, the bow tie has all these different ways to tie it. Mm-hmm. And again, it doesn't matter. If it's a little sloppy, it's okay.
Oh, people will think you're wearing a clip-on if it's perfect.
Yeah.
Oh,
no,
I never want perfect.
You don't want that. And I think
don't
a traditional tie, you know, we want to show guys that there's so many different ways to wear a tie, a Plattsburgh, a, you know, a half Windsor, a full Windsor, all these different ways to tie it.
Do you have a favorite, by the way? You have a favorite?
I like the Plattsburgh.
You like the Plattsburgh? Yeah. What about you, Corey?
I'm a Windsor guy.
You're a Windsor guy?
Yeah.
It's that banking thing.
It depends. You know what? It depends. It depends on the tie. It completely depends on the tie.
It does.
I half Windsor a lot.
Yeah.
But I Plattsboro a lot, too.
Yeah.
It just depends on the tie.
Yeah.
Well, listen, thanks a whole lot for
absolutely
being here. And
thank you.
I'm looking very forward to our tie venture.
As we are, too.
Thanks a lot, guys. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I really wanted to have Adam and Corey from Hook and Albert on the show because I'm excited about this bow tie line. I'm getting into that fashion space, as they say, and no, I'm not going to run off and start making suits and stuff. But it's nice to get into this whole bow tie thing, and I'm passionate about it, I guess. But I wanted to tie it into food because, after all, the Alton Browncast has always got to have some food in it, right? So I started thinking, well, okay, all the ties that I have are named after food, and my favorite one is probably the one that I call the Salmon Hunter, which is kind of salmon color plaid on one side and camouflage on the other. And I love this tie; it's a lot of fun. So I thought, okay, I will do honor to this tie by talking some about salmon, which is indeed one of my favorite fish to eat. But I'm kind of picky about it, and I want to explain why. Most of the salmon that is sold in the United States is Atlantic salmon. That is an actual variety. It's not just where it's from, okay? It is a variety. And I would say that 99% of the Atlantic salmon sold in American markets is grown via aquaculture. Okay, it is raised in fish farms. Now, I have got absolutely nothing against fish farms, and a lot of fish, even salmon cousins like trout, do very well in aquacultural situations. I do not, however, believe that salmon do a very good job in that. They don't like that environment. A lot has to be added to them in order to get the flavor and the color and to keep them healthy. Salmon are supposed to range far and wide in the water. They live out in the ocean and they swim up rivers, and it's very, very difficult to imitate or, you know, replace that natural life in an aquacultural situation. So I personally will not eat farmed Atlantic salmon. Yes, it is more inexpensive by a long shot than wild salmon. But you know what? I like salmon enough to not eat that because I can tell the difference. I can tell the difference looking at one of them in the store. Their noses are always blunt. Their tails are ragged and shorter because they've been living butt up right up against a bunch of their neighbors. And they're just not meant to live that way. So I don't like Atlantic farmed salmon. A lot of farmed fish, aquaculture fish, I do like. This is simply not one of them. However, there is a lot of Pacific salmon to choose from. Unlike Atlantic, there are actually several varieties of salmon out in the Pacific waters. You've got your king or Chinook in season, typically in the spring. The silvers and cohos come into season in the summertime. Sockeye, my personal favorite, deep red flesh, spring and fall. the Chums or Kata, lower fat version of salmon, which usually ends up in canned salmon. They don't swim as far upstream, so they don't have to store up as much fat in their systems. So you very, very rarely see those in fresh or, you know, fillet form. Then you've got pink salmon, which I think one's the latest. It'll go all the way to October, and it's also canned most of the time. My favorites, I mean, the big ones are king, chinook, silver, coho, and sockeye. These are fish that get a lot of fat built up in them before they go up into rivers, and they are truly delicious. You get hold of an Alaska king salmon, and you won't want another salmon. I mean, you'll want another of those, but you're not going to want other salmon because they're so delicious. I've been fortunate enough to catch my own king salmon up in Washington State. You can catch them from Washington all the way up Canada into Alaska. My personal favorite is Alaska salmon, and I almost always get them frozen. I do not mind frozen fish. If it is caught and quickly frozen on a factory ship, I think that it is actually superior to what other people would call fresh, which I would just call raw. I've got no problem with that. Remember, fresh is not the same thing as raw. And you know, fresh should be closest to the living condition, which I think in a lot of cases is frozen. So I go for silver or coho, king, chinook, sockeye when in season. And I want to say right now, one of the reasons you ought to be eating these fish is that they are very high in omega 3 fatty acids. I'm sure you've heard of omega-3s. This is a very, very heart-healthy polyunsaturated oil. And the reason it's called omega-3 is that it has, because it's polyunsaturated, it has a lot of carbon atoms that are double bonded to themselves because they're not bonded to hydrogens. And the last of these double bonds appears at the third position back from the end of the molecule. You probably didn't need to know that, but that's why it's called omega-3. The last double bond of the polyunsaturated structure is three links back from the end of the molecule. Just, you know, so you know. And it puts a funky little kink, actually. Every time that there's a double bond, it puts a little kink in the molecule, which is why the fat acts the way that it does. But this is a very, very, very good oil for you. It is available in a lot of different sea creatures, especially salmon and oily fish, and some plants too. They're also loaded up with niacin. You got your vitamin B6, 12, selenium, magnesium. Of course, you got a really nice protein there. And I think there's even a good bit of phosphorus in there. So this is a fish you ought to be eating. But I say buy it wild and just don't buy it as often if you don't have to. A good salmon doesn't need much done to it, to be really honest. I roast them or I grill them with just a little bit of salt. I don't want to mess around with it. The last thing I want to see is a beautiful piece of salmon all smeared up with spices and blah, blah, blah. I have perpetrated this crime personally. As a matter of fact, in a spice show that we did on Good Eats, I made this spice pomade to go on top of salmon. And I'm kind of ashamed of it because you know what? I use that to cover up, you know, Atlantic salmon, which I just don't eat anymore. I don't do it. So, you know, do yourself a favor and just forget that I ever said that. Put that on some other fish. But I do have one slightly more complicated or involved procedure that I will execute with salmon when I get them. I especially do this with sockeye if I can get whole fish. And this is a recipe that requires two entire sides of salmon. Anything from a really big king salmon, you might be able to only do one fillet. But I usually do these with smaller silver or sockeyes. And this is a recipe or an application I'm going to talk you through on smoking them. Now, I'm pretty, well, I'm not necessarily well-known. The people that know me know that I like to smoke in cardboard boxes. That's because I've got a good smoker, but it's relatively small, and salmon can be quite long. So I literally will build a smoker out of a decent-sized cardboard box. I'll go down to, like, U-Haul or someplace, and I'll buy myself a good one that's long enough for me to get an oven rack in or a cooling rack, and I'll either drive dowels, wooden dowels, through the side of the box and then set the racks on those. Or sometimes I make little hangers out of wire and hang them down. I cut a hole down in the sidewall so I can sneak a cord through. And I use just a hardware store hot pan, hot plate rather, plug it in to heat, turn it up all the way, put a small, I've got this small kind of beat up cast iron skillet. I put the wood chips in that or sawdust, which is even better if you've got a furniture place around you that makes cabinets. Get just like, you know, oak or maple, maple sawdust, and just put in the pan and use that as your hot smoker. And then you put the fish on the rack above that. And of course you do this outside. I shouldn't have to say it. Then you just close the box. And I usually just set something like I used to have an old plate weight that was like a 5-pound weight. I would park on top of it. And I would just let it go. And I would sometimes stick instant read thermometer down through the box to read the air temperature, because I'd like the air temperature to stay, or the smoke temperature to stay, pretty close to what I want the final temperature of the fish to be, which for me is right around 145 degrees. That way I kind of maximize, I want to maximize the smoke time. If I get to a cooked fish in an hour, then I haven't gotten much smoke. So I shoot for the smoke to be the same temperature as the final temperature. And then the fish is basically just coming into equilibrium with the smoke, which makes sense when you think about it. But here's the deal. As uncomplicated as it is to smoke fish, you do have to cure it or brine it first. There's a few reasons for this. One, you want to get flavor into it, some flavor, simple flavor, but still flavor. And the other thing is you want to create what's called a pellicle. Now, a pellicle is essentially this dry protein surface on the fish that acts like Velcro to smoke. And it is very difficult to get smoke to stick and move into fish if it has not been cured so that this pellicle can be produced. So I tend to use a dry rub, and the amount I'm about to give you is enough to do two sides or two fillets of a good size, say, salmon. I like to fillet the fish myself. If you don't like to do that, ask your fishmonger to do it. Buy whole fish and then ask him to just fillet out the two sides. And then if he's really nice or she's really nice, ask him to pull out the pin bones, because you're going to want to get the pin bones out of there. You can do that with pliers, but if you haven't done it before, you can make a mess of it. But you need to learn how if you tend to do this kind of thing. So go online and look up pin bone removal or something like that. I've got this pair of food grade stainless steel pliers that I use for pulling those out. Remember, salmon have essentially two rib cages. So you can cut the fillets off of one of them, but the other rib cage kind of sticks into the meat, and that's got to go. They're big things, look like nails almost. This is my basic cure mixture, and it's the smallest amount. What I'm going to give you is the smallest amount I would make. Cup, it's real easy, okay? Cup of kosher salt, half cup granulated sugar, half cup dark brown sugar, tablespoon crushed black peppercorns. Done. That's it. I don't add any dill. I don't add any curry. I mean, that's it. Basic cure. Salt's all we really require. The sugar's there to balance that. Okay. Remember, sugar is hygroscopic, whereas salt isn't. So I could desiccate or over dry the fish with just the salt. So I want the sugar there so that they work with each other. I want to use the salt to pull those water soluble proteins up to the surface of the meat. I want the sugar to help, you know, kind of control what the salt gets to get away with, if you will. So I almost always, I can't think of any fish cure that I use that isn't half salt, half sugar. It's the yin and yang. It's two sides of the same coin. So what I do is I mix that up in a bowl, okay? And sometimes what I'll do is I'll put the peppercorns and I'll start with, now that amount that I gave you, a tablespoon was the crushed amount. So what I might start with is a tablespoon plus a teaspoon, put it in the food processor, pulse it up a few times just to break those up, then add the sugars and the salt and kind of just process them together to make sure that everything's nice and even. It's just a kind of a fast way of doing it, but you could do it by hand if you want. All right, you want to take a piece of heavy-duty aluminum foil, which comes in wider rolls, and you want to roll out a piece that's about 3 inches longer than the fish fillet, all right? Then top that with a piece of plastic wrap that's essentially the same size, the same length at least. It won't be as wide, and that's okay. So then sprinkle about a third of this cure mixture just lightly onto the plastic, kind of in the shape of where the fish is going to go. You want to make a bed for the fish. Then you're going to set the first fillet down on that plastic, skin down. Okay, skin down. Another third of the mixture goes on top of the fish. That would be on the flesh side. Then lay the next fillet on top of that. All right, right on top of the first one, flesh down, and then use the remainder, the final third, to cover the skin on that top piece. Then just fold over the plastic to kind of make a nice little envelope, nice and you know, sealed, and then crimp the foil in place, okay? Then just park that in the refrigerator, like on a sheet pan. And typically what I do, I actually like to weigh mine a little bit to compress the meat a little bit. I think that it makes the cure work faster. I have had some people argue with me. So what I do is I place another sheet pan on top of this and then put a couple of cans of like canned soup or canned beans on top of that to weigh it down. I've even used a phone book before, but you just basically want a couple of pounds weighing down on it to help that cure penetrate. Put that in the refrigerator for 12 hours. Okay, then flip the package over and refrigerate another 12. So we've got 24 hours of cure time. Okay, 24 hours. Do not skimp on this. Okay. Don't think, oh, well, I don't need that much pellicle. I'll just do it in 6 hours. No, that fish died for you. Don't do that to that fish. You want this to be done right. You unwrap the fish then when you're on the day that you're going to smoke. Okay. rinse off the cure with cold water. Literally put it under the sink, rinse all of it out, pat everything dry with paper towels, and then put someplace nice and cool and dry, not the refrigerator, until the surface of that fish is kind of matte-like. It'll take an hour or two. I actually use a fan, an oscillating fan that's usually in my little home gym. I will set that up on the counter and blow air across it. And I'm typically doing this in a cool room. You can do this during summer, but it's a little bit difficult because it starts to sweat out. So I blow air on it in order to get this kind of matte finish. That's that pellicle. Because what we've done is we've pulled some water-soluble proteins up to the surface of the meat. Then we want to dry them to create the pellicle. Then, while that's going on, set up your smoking rig. Keep in mind, if you use my method with the hot plate, you can tinker with that hot plate in order to get a temperature of about 150 degrees inside the box is what you want to be able to maintain. So I'll even set that up before I put the wood on, just to kind of tinker with getting that setting right. Now, if you're just starting to do this, you're probably going to have to reach into the box to do that. I've gotten around that by actually installing a little dimmer on the cable down line from the hot plate so that it's outside the box and I can actually change the temperature from outside. That's an easy thing to install. And since you're doing this outside, it's nothing scary is going to happen. Just make sure it doesn't have to be grounded because most of the hot plates aren't grounded. So just a good kind of heavy duty commercial dimmer will allow you to change that temperature. So we're looking for 150 degrees. You put the smoke on the rack over, like I said, hardwood and cook until that fish reaches 150 degrees. Now this is a hot smoking process. It is not the kind of cold smoke that one would do to preserve the fish for a long time. This is just to make it amazingly delicious. Try to not let the temperature get over 160 degrees during the smoking time. Equally good on trout, mackerel, bluefish also. It's a great method. Give it a try sometime. All right, faithful listeners, that is all we have got for you today. We will return the control of your digital device or computer back over to you and release you to your day. Thank you for your time and attention. And keep in mind, another episode or edition, we can't decide which one to go with, of the Alton Brown cast will be coming down the pike here shortly. So until then, America, do me a favor and cook smart, okay?